You're listening to The Plug with Neil Griffith.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of The Plug Podcast with me, Neil Griffiths. Thanks for listening. How you doing? It's been a week, and by that I mean we've recorded like 3 or 4 episodes. So we've got like a month's worth of episodes to release, which is really exciting, but I'm pumped about this episode because I am joined by Wesley Schultz, the guitarist and lead singer of US folk rock band The Lumineers. Wesley came on ahead of the band's Australian tour this month. They'll be here in a few weeks, actually. They're going to be playing the debut Harvest Rock Festival in Adelaide alongside names like Jack White, Crowded House, and Tones and I, who was actually on the podcast a few weeks ago. They'll also be playing headline shows around the country in Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. For details on dates and to get your hands on some tickets, check out harvestrock.com. I last spoke to Wesley at Splendor in the Grass 2019, right before their third album, 3, came out, and their fourth album, Brightside, was released back in January, so it was really interesting to sit down and talk about everything that happened since then. The guys have just wrapped a huge US tour, including some first ever stadium shows. We spoke about some lessons he learned from Bono and U2 when they toured together a few years back, and he also gave an update on new music and when we can possibly expect album number 5. Here is the full episode with Wesley Schultz from The Lumineers on The Plug Podcast. And welcoming to The Plug Podcast, Wesley Schultz of The Lumineers. Wesley, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
How's everything going, dude? I know we've got a lot to talk about in this episode, but let's start with you. You're in Denver right now, right? Having some downtime, I imagine?
Yeah. I'm at home. We just got done with a North American tour that was about 5 months and had the last few weeks off. So kind of recharged and ready to roll again. It's really excited to go down under and to like basically see other parts of the world because we've been domestic for a while now.
Yeah, I did see that you did get to have a Halloween, which was nice. You were Santa Claus, right? How was that?
Yeah, my son chose all of our costumes. So my wife and I were both required to be Santa Claus. There was no Mrs. Claus. And
did you at least put that offer to it?
Yeah, we said, well, why doesn't Randy be Mrs. Claus? And he's like, no, Santa Claus. So we're like, all right, very 2022 of you.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Very progressive. I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude, I mentioned before, it's great to be chatting because I'm not sure if you remember, I spoke to you last when you guys came to Australia at the Splendor in the Grass Festival. We were backstage. It was 2019, which feels like a lifetime ago. I actually got like pneumonia the very next day. You didn't get sick from that festival, did you?
No, luckily I did not get sick, but that feels like not 3 years, but like 7 years ago.
It does, doesn't it?
It's crazy. Yeah, time has moved differently.
Yeah, it's been a while for years, and we'll get to the album in a second, but you mentioned at the start that you've had a huge US tour. You've played with guys like James Bay, who was actually on the podcast recently. Nice. But we got to give a shout out to some of these shows, Coorsfield in your hometown of Denver, and obviously Wrigley in Chicago. What's it like to play in front of 180,000 people in one night?
It was more like 40,000, but
no, that's not what we're telling people. It was 180.
It was like Nebworth. It felt like our Nebworth for those of you who are Oasis fans out there. I think for us, I think about it like as a fan, you think you always want to see your favorite band in a club. And that's the dream. And you think that somehow the quality of the show is inevitably going to go down because it's a small, a bigger venue and it's less personal. But I was lucky enough to go see Bruce Springsteen when I was a little, you know, about 20, 25 years ago. And he played at Giant Stadium. And so that's about 55,000 people. And I was so moved by the show. And I had the second to last seats in the whole place. So basically the most nosebleed of nosebleed seats. And I was so moved by the show. And I had the similar experience with the Dave Matthews show years before that. And so I realized it could be done, but you have to be very intentional about trying to connect with the back row and making it a show that translates not only to the people right in front of you, but all the way back. So in that way, I had a good experience going into this as far as feeling like it could be great, but we had to really put our intentions with that. Basically, hold on 1 second. Jesus. This is why I got kids rolling around and like, hey guys, I got to do an interview. Hi, buddy. Oh, I love you the most. Well, that was the cutest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Now, you know what? I might even keep that in the podcast. Man. That was very wholesome.
Yeah. Man, I did not expect that. He's been a character lately and saying all sorts of crazy stuff. So that was like as if I paid him to do that. But yeah, I think what I'm getting at, the long-winded thing I'm sort of speaking around, is that there's this reputation of bigger venues being less satisfying and for the bands and for the fans. And for us, for whatever reason, they were some of the most exciting, gratifying shows we had ever played. And I think we were like little kids. That's part of it. We were just truly excited to be there, you know. And in Denver, we have Red Rocks here, and Red Rocks brings out the best out of performers. And I grew up in New Jersey, and our nearest big venue is Madison Square Garden, and you'd always get the best shows from bands coming through there. It was like playing Carnegie Hall for a rock band or something, you know. It was like,
yeah,
there was some prestige to it and this aura about it that it's indescribable, but it brings out these performances that if you went and saw that band in another city, you might see a different edge to the band. And it's just this amazing thing. And I think when you see a band that is really amazed that they're even in the venue they're playing, like when I remember when we first played Australia, it didn't matter where we were playing. It was, we're in Australia, and you get this certain magic to that. And so for us, playing those really big venues was not only gratifying, but I think I talked to fans and friends after the show. I met people in the street, but also just like, this was the days after, and it was magic. It was truly magic. And then Wrigley as well. So playing Coors Field, these are both baseball stadiums in the US, and they're places that we never even desired to play, to be honest. I think I always assumed that was like something you had to decide to do and then maybe do it one day. And I think the charm of the experience for us was that we really never really put an intention out to do any of that. We're sort of this little engine that could, that kept playing. The venues kept growing, but that wasn't our desire. And so in that way, I think it felt like a fairy tale where we were just like, I can't believe we're here. What the fuck is going on? Mm-hmm. And had some of our best shows because there was that adrenaline, but we were also playing so often and locked in with each other that you got this magic.
How much stock can you put into those shows though? Like when you're touring a lot and you're playing a lot of shows, I imagine it can get you go from city to city, show to show. But when you are performing in front of that many people in venues that big and that iconic as well, do you kind of make a plan of, let's just not talk about it until we're about to go on stage? Or are you just thinking every minute of every fucking day, we're about to go and play Coors Field, we're going to Coors Field? How does that work?
I think I get more nervous playing to, let's say, a half empty room than I do to a room that is full of people that want to be there and feel good about it. So I played living rooms that I was, I think, more nervous for than these bigger venues. So part of it is, whatever, this is like maybe a little bit of a side note, but part of it is that you have this desire to play a room that doesn't feel lonely, right? So that's the worst part. If it's a club, we played plenty of living rooms coming up. If it's not really feeling full, people look around and they go, I guess this must not be good. So it doesn't matter the size. You want there to be a buy-in from the audience that I'm here and this is special. And that's like the biggest thing to overcome as a band is when you play a place and it's really, really under, undersold, I guess you could say, or underattended. That's really hard. But like, I think for this, it depended on the band member you talked to. Like for our piano player, Stealth, he grew up in Colorado. So to play Coors Field was insane to him. And for me, playing Madison Square Garden was the thing that really tweaked me out in a good way, but just was like, I couldn't believe that was happening. So to each their own with those types of things. But you try to, I think about it. I was like really into sports growing up. And I think one of the things I realized about the best players was that it wasn't that they got better in the high pressure moments. It was that they stayed themselves in the high pressure moments. And they did this study on the idea of clutch, you know, in quotes, like who's clutch, who's really good in the moment. And they started to realize that the guys who were considered clutch weren't, their batting average or whatever you were studying, their shooting percentage didn't really go up. It just maintained because they stayed within themselves. And how do you do that? And I think that was a big part of playing those big venues was not pressing and not doing more than you normally need to do, because the adrenaline will carry you so far. You're, you know, everything is hyped up naturally. So you just need to kind of like stay within yourself. And we did that. And I felt more present, weirdly, with those shows than I had for a lot of them. And maybe it was just because there was a piece about that idea in my head. Like, you don't need to be more than you are. You know what I mean? In the beginning, that's what you constantly feel. I felt, at least, was that you're like an imposter. Like, why are they even here? And
yeah,
at a certain point, you're like, I think I know why they're here. And I've made peace with this for a little while now. I think they're here not because of me. They're here because of this thing between us. And I think of it like this glowing orb or something. It's like, what that is the music. And we're exchanging that. You know, we were part of making it. We were sort of these antennas that charted it and put it down on paper or put it on an album. But it's outside of yourself. So it's like you're both sharing in that. In that joy, in that moment, as opposed to, it can get really dicey for someone's ego or how they're looking at it. If they think everyone's there to see them and them as a person, no one really knows you, but they know their music and they've had a relationship with that. So that also is that's the way I think about it. And I think it's a healthier way than thinking like, how great am I? That's why they're here. Cause that's just going to be a pitfall after pitfall.
I've just moved to New York and you've said, you know, playing Madison Square Garden is your big deal. And I'm just going to see a show at Madison Square. And I'm like, fuck, I've made it. And I'm just a guy in the crowd. Like, that's wild to me.
It's got a vibe. Yeah. I remember listening to Jay-Z growing up and like, he's like, sold out the Garden in a day. And I'm like, we did that too.
Oh, in a day?
Like we sold the Garden out a day and then sold the second show out, like on the same run. And it was like,
didn't do that, did you, Jay-Z?
For the first time ever, I can relate to a Jay-Z line, like, personally.
Well, it's funny you mentioned it's the fear of, like, playing into a half-empty room. I remember at Splendor, I think you guys were playing maybe overlapped. It wasn't the exact same time, but it was an overlap with Childish Gambino, who was on the main stage. And your stage was still so incredibly packed out that you would have been mistaken for thinking, okay, this is, like, the main headline show. Because I remember, like, I'm very much Splendor, when there's like the headliner of the whole festival is on, the other stages might suffer. Your stage didn't suffer at all.
Yeah, I don't. And you never know, you know, that could change year to year and album to album. You just don't know. It's like the weather. But I think what I like about stories like that is that I think we have been, and I hope continue to be, like these underdogs where there's not really a, like, there's not a full awareness in the general culture or something around like what we're doing. But when you come to a show, oh, I know that song. Oh, I know that song. Oh, I know, like, there's something about it that creeps in and stays with you and haunts you a little bit that I think those are some of my favorite bands. And I like, you know, when we played these stadiums, like the two we played on this run were Coors Field and Wrigley. Our nanny, Megan, is from Chicago, and she was, so I said, we're playing Wrigley. How crazy is that? And she's like, cool. So is there like a baseball game after? And that's our nanny. I mean, she's with us every day. She goes on tour with us. She sees it all. And even for her, it was like a stretch to be like, wait, so how does this work? I don't get it. And
did you fire her for that attitude?
I think I would hire her for that attitude. I like that because there's something about, I don't think it boils down to someone doubting you. It's just, we're all just like, it's not a given. And it's pretty surprising, even to us, even to the people who are close around us. The same thing actually happened when we played Madison Square Garden. I had close friends who said, who are you opening for? And I was like, both of those shows are our shows. They're like, no shit. For some reason, I think I'd rather have that attitude than like someone who has these insane expectations and then somehow is unimpressed. It's like, we should all be grateful for this. This is crazy. And the minute it stops feeling that way, it's a shame, because it's been a really charmed run we've had the last 10 years. And I think part of my goal, regardless of the size of the venue, was to prove that, you know, it wasn't an aberration. You know, you want to kind of prove yourself with every song, with every album, that and now every show. Like you asked earlier about the bigger venues and how you feel about how to approach. And I think part of it that my managers and booking agents probably like laugh at is when I get off stage and I feel like the show was good, I'll say something like, I feel like, you know, we belonged up there. It wasn't like we were some, no one was doing us a favor. Like we, that made sense. And for them, they're like, yeah, did I booked you there? And it's like, for us, we don't know until you try. You know, it might come off, you might play it and go, you know what? I like playing theaters more.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like you have to keep an open mind, I think, with it, because the goal shouldn't be gluttonous. It shouldn't be bigger, bigger, bigger. But having seen some certain acts do it so well and that connection made, like when we open for U2, I think that happens to every band that opens for U2, is that they see something that is like looking at, it's like staring at Medusa or something. You know, you're just like, you shouldn't see it because it's too much. Like,
yeah.
We were on their Joshua Tree 30th anniversary tour, which is even more crazy because they're playing the album, the entire album, and people are weeping in the stands, and it's stadium after stadium. And it's like the first show we played with them was two nights at Pasadena. It was 90,000 people at the Rose Bowl each night. And Bono's like, yeah, every time we play a show, the crowd decides your fate. Like, do you live or do you die? And he's like, last night in Seattle, we died. Like, he was saying that they didn't have a good enough show. And I was like, wow, he cares that much that it goes the right way. Like, he wants to create a show and a moment. And there's a lot of caricatures and parodies of U2, but I think when we were around it, we saw how much they actually cared about how good the show was. And they would change the order of certain songs and, you know, just like really fine tune things. When we took a ride on their plane from one city to another, they were kind enough to bring us on for one of those. And like, I just watched them discussing the set even that night. So I think people assume that a band that is that big just has it. It's almost like Michael Jordan didn't have to practice or something. And it's like, well, Michael Jordan missed a lot of potential game winners. And, you know, depending on what sport analogy you want, all the greats failed a lot too. It's what they do when they failed that really determined it, you know? And I think watching them be so precise and care about it, it was an eye-opening experience. But it was also like, wow, you can do this to a big crowd, and it's not less, it's actually more, because you feel like this collective energy, you know, with a crowd. It's like being at a festival when you see a crowd undulate and move all as one. That's not like watching a show on your laptop during the pandemic. It just never will be. So part of that is the collective consciousness and like this thing that happens as a group, that's what's so special about live music.
Was there a fear when you opened for U2, not for the point of the big audiences, but the old saying goes, never meet your heroes. Was there a fear that you could meet U2 and they could be the exact opposite of what you described in, you know, they're so iconic, they're essentially a machine, that you would go to these shows, the band members don't talk, they don't talk to you, they're all very smug. Was there a fear that, oh God, we could go here and U2 are going to be the worst people we've ever met?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I feel like that about bands that I want, like, either to open for us or I want to open for, is that I don't want to ruin whatever impression I in my mind I had of them. And it might even be just that they're having a bad day, but what if I only have one show to open for them and that's when their bad day happens? So there is that element of not wanting to mess up a thing in your mind. But with this, we knew it was going to be, I think it was 12 or 13 shows. So I felt like they were letting us know in action that they respected us. And there are situations where you're put on a bill and you kind of sense like this is just obligatory. They didn't really care. And there are other instances where it feels very curated by the band and that they really liked what you do and want you as a part of that. So I think for us, we sense like, especially because we got to meet them right off the bat, didn't take many shows. It was just a great experience, but that you run the risk, you know. It's like, I got to meet Tom Petty. That's probably my favorite meeting of a hero of all time. And he just surpassed his, he was generous and he was funny and he was kind. And I had told him that my wife had walked down the aisle to his song Walls, which is why we ended up covering it. And he ended up telling a friend that, a couple of his friends that I know, and told me back that he had told him the story. And I was like, so not only did we have an exchange, but somehow he remembered what I said before he passed. And it's just unbelievable. And I think, I mean, growing up in New Jersey, like I mentioned earlier, Springsteen is kind of famous for making connections quickly with his fans and for anybody he comes across. He's just very generous. And that's kind of like who he is just a social connective person, and open. And everybody always says, like, friends and family will ask, like, so is it tough when you get recognized? Is that like, because I say, well, our songs might be famous, we're not really famous, but the songs, some people might know songs. And but I did say, like, you know, if you have a standoffish holier than thou attitude, it actually drives people more mad to want to meet you. And if you're just, I think, more open and genuine and kind, it just kind of creates a more normal interaction that is not so taxed and stressed by, I don't know. I think of like a Marilyn Manson type where they're just, they've created this character and it's like, they're trying to stay in that. And when you meet them, they're not willing to become a human being because that would break the facade. And I was never really interested in that. I really just love writing songs. Like, I probably would have been just as happy just sitting behind the scenes and writing songs for other people. I just love to this day writing, and then the performance, I had to grow and learn how to do that and enjoy it. And luckily it turned a corner, and I have, but like, that's where I come from, and that's the school of thought. So it's an interesting, and I strangely enough got the sense, as much as people think of U2 a certain way, that they were just kids that love making music that happen to be the age they are, but they're still those kids that met in grade school and make music together.
There are some musicians where fame can get to them, and then clearly there are others like a Springsteen, like you mentioned, where they're just untouched by fame. And obviously, same with Lumineers. Yeah, sure, you're not Bono, but you guys have just been going up and up and up since album number one, and you're completely unfazed by this. You know, you're humbled by the fact that you're playing a venue like Coors or even Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, it's like confusing, you know, because I always joke that we're like this food cart that got a Michelin star or something, where it's like, there's still not enough capacity, you know, like, but I like it that way. And I think it kind of, like, if you think too hard on it, there's no sense made of it. It's just, there's a great book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And it, I don't know if have you read it?
No.
It's a great book. And he talks about the confluences of events that have to happen for success to happen on a large scale. And I read it before anything happened with the band. And it was very good that I read that, because he talks about Bill Gates, he talks about the Beatles, he talks about athletes and all the, not only their skill and their drive and determination, but all the other things that had to go the right way in order for them to be who they are. I mean, Bono talked about it. I think when he got inducted into the Hall of Fame, he was like, there would be no U2 today based on this. And I heard Springsteen say that the other day. He's like, I'm so glad I came up when I did, because the world was open to my music. And I feel that way too, in some weird ways. Like, it's only been 10 years since we came on the scene, but it's even changed. You have to be like a TikTok thing or something to like really ascend. And I'm like, we're like grandpas, but somehow we like snuck in the back door and we're okay. But we're kind of like, I grew up listening to Steve Miller Band a lot, and like their greatest hits my dad had. And like, no one knew what that guy looked like. No one cared. They just liked his music. And that's kind of what I loved. I was like, that, what a cool life. You get to like go to grocery store and get your stuff, come back, no one bothers you. And then you get to go play music and they're like, oh, that's the guy. Cause I've gotten so many times where I go out to restaurants, this is in Denver, and sometimes some other places, and they'll say, you know, you look like the guy from the Lumineers. And I'm like, oh yeah. And like, you just either you leave it or you laugh or whatever, and it maybe it comes out, maybe it doesn't. But I'd rather it that way than me be the product, I guess you could say. I don't think I have the personality for it. I think I'd be tired by that. I'm more like introverted, and I like keeping to myself. And when I go out on stage, I try to give as much as I can, and then the boundary line starts after that, you know. And then it's like my life, and I let who I can let in. And but it's a for someone like a Post Malone, I can't believe how busy that guy must be just living his life, much less, playing a show, like doing what he does. It's insanely exhausting as it is. And then to have performance off stage as well, which is kind of what it is. It's got to be tough.
It's funny. I had Kings of Leon on the show maybe like a year ago when their album came out, and they kind of probably had a similar start to you guys, and that, you know, alt rock bands, very quiet, kept themselves, just produced great fucking music. But then they admitted, like, along the way, as they started getting more successful, they kind of lent into the rock style lifestyle, you know, the private jets, the partying. And they said everything went to shit. We almost broke up. We all hated each other. And then when they kind of decided, let's stop all this and get back to making music, they said they've never been happier because they're doing what they started with. Take out the fame, take out the money, take out the partying, whatever you want to call it. What they're doing now is what they started, what the whole reason they started, which is to make music and just play together.
First of all, yeah, those guys are an enormous inspiration. Their first four albums alone, like, are so rich and dense with, I mean, that guy's voice is like, I've never heard anybody sing like that. And the way they built their songs, they were so quirky, a lot of them. And I think that really, I mean, we drew a lot of inspiration from those first four. And then I heard recently their most recent, and I could hear the love back in the music. I could hear, you know, I think there's something about making music for love, and then there's something about making music for out of fear. And you can kind of smell it, like when someone is actually risking and when someone's being still vulnerable. And then you can also smell it when someone's going like safe a little bit and saying, you know, I know this is a hit, I know this is catchy, whatever it is. And it's like with those guys, the quirk of them was always the biggest charm. It was like they just did these strange things in their music, but it was still really hooky and amazing. And it doesn't surprise me that that's the backstory, though. I didn't know that, because there is like such a sort of like outward pressure, depending on who you surround yourself with, to live a life that doesn't disappoint the people you're hanging out with. You know, like every city you go to, there's a family member or a friend or a fan that's their one night they're seeing you. They don't care about your show tomorrow night. And the person tomorrow night doesn't care about what you did last night. And you have to understand that you're not there to be the mascot of rock and roll necessarily. Like, you're there for me. I'm there on the road to put on good shows. And if I have time to hang, if I have time to hang, awesome. But I'll be 40 this year. The hangovers last a few days now if I stay out real late. So it's like, and then I have kids. So now I'm getting up at whenever they get, it's wild. So part of it is just feeling like, hey, I have a duty to have a good show. And then everything else is icing on the cake. But I totally get it. And those guys, I mean, they were at it since they were young. So I feel like part of their, like the difference, big difference between, say, a band like them and us is also that they blew up in Europe and overseas outside of the US when they were in their teens, like late teens. And I was 30 when we got signed. So like I had a childhood. I had moments where I acted like out of the public eye, just like a moron, and got wasted and everything. And then we hit we got lucky and we got found and everything. Those guys, I feel like, got stripped of a little bit of their early adulthood to go work in this intense job. So it's no wonder it's like those child stars that they kind of rebel when they're a little old to be rebelling. And you're like, well, I kind of get it. I mean, most of us had the right to fuck off and be an idiot. And no one, you weren't in a tabloid, you weren't talked about in that way, because you were just another person. But for them, they were in the spotlight.
Looking to take your home recording studio to the next level? The new Audio-Technica AT2020 USB-X condenser microphone has been specifically designed for musos, podcasters, and content creators who want the best quality sound with the easiest setup possible. It features a built-in headphone jack with volume control to let you directly monitor the microphone signal with no delay, and has a silent touch-sensitive mute button to quickly and easily mute audio at the microphone. Whether you're looking for the best streaming microphone or looking to enhance your content creation for YouTube videos, the AT2020 USB-X is the optimal choice for all types of content creation. For more details on how you can get your hands on this microphone, head over to audiotechnica.com.
Again, we met in 2019. It's funny to think that even then we were still months away from the release of 3, and we're almost a year on from the release of Brightside. So 10 months late, congratulations on Brightside, my friend. Fucking loved it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's weird, especially in the last 2 years, having all these bands and artists on throughout the pandemic and how all their plans were stopped. Some made more music and made a new album. Some just took it as a gigantic hiatus. I know that you guys, you and Jeremiah, despite the fact that it was COVID and Jeremiah was moving from Denver to Italy, This album process was really, it worked out great for you guys. And I know Jeremiah's been quoted as saying that he doesn't think he could go back to the quote old way of making records. So I guess the all-encompassing question there is, why was this album process so special for you guys? And what about the COVID pandemic is going to make you adopt those same approaches potentially for the next album, if there is one?
Well, I'll give you, I like analogies. So I'll tell you a story. Like, so when my wife and I met Brandy, her name is Brandy. She was, she said to me later on, she said, when we first met or when we first hooked up, I knew her for about a year, we were friends. And then she's like, I decided that I was going to get good at like just hooking up and not having feelings about it. Like I was going to have a one night stand and not like get attached. And I was her first experiment. And and then we ended up getting married. And it was like, she went into it with zero expectation. She was like, I'm not trying to find a husband or anything. I'm not even a boyfriend. I just want some action. And I felt like making this album Brightside, we went in literally saying out loud, I think maybe we'll get one song out of this. If we get one, we get two, we're playing with house money for whatever the next record is that we make. And one and two turn into three and four turn into nine and 10 songs. So it was like, I felt like we went into it with zero expectations, born out of a real circumstance, you know, saying like, I was about to have, my wife was about to give birth to our daughter. And so the recording session revolved around 3 weeks before she was born. And then a month later, 3 weeks after she was born, like we were just like, I don't even know if we have time. The expectations were so low that we were just free. You know, we were freed by not trying to make something and that weight of that in the room. It was just like every idea that we loved usually began with, this is probably a dumb idea, but check this out. And it was very playful and it was very, there's a lot of joy in that. And the days seem to fly by. And when you're holding on too tightly and you're trying to control things and be overly meticulous and almost OCD, it can take the joy out of it and it can make the days feel longer. And I think that we were at times guilty of that on the first couple records, especially because we were just by nature really, you know, we would comb through every detail and everything. And this was just less like that. And it was so fun. And there was more trust in each other and ourselves than there probably could have been on the first few.
So going off what Jeremiah said about not wanting to go back to the old ways of making records, do you think this is how you're going to approach things from now on? Just go in red hot, make a bunch of songs. If some are great, awesome. If they're terrible, just keep going.
I think it's a mixture because we really go fast in the demo process, if you're talking about the new way, where it's just the difference was that we knew the ideas at their core, at the bones of the ideas we were going at the Brightside were fine and were great. Like, but they were all voice memos just on a phone. It was just me and Jer sitting in a room, really crude representations of the song that needed a ton more fleshing out. And in the past, we were actually recording the whole thing soup to nuts over and over on Pro Tools and then bringing that to a studio. So a lot of it is like I want to make records that like you'd never have to skip a song and that you just fall in love with front to back. And so I don't, for us, I don't know if you really can just like trust every idea you have. Some of them are not that good. You have to know that. But there are artists that their highs are so incredibly high and their lows are incredibly low. And like there's a charm to that. But for us, I really like, it was sort of a hybrid, you know, where we knew the base of it was great. And then we just let it rip. So it's like sort of getting your ducks in a row in a way, but then just going for it. And I felt like the performances in particular on Brightside were way better. Like on our second album, there's a song, Angela. Angela was the buzzer beater of the record. It was like the thing that we didn't even have done and didn't think was going to be on the record at all. And we wrote it in the studio, and that you could feel the performance is just different because it wasn't so memorized and, you know, looked like poured over. And that's what the whole Brightside felt like. So I think you got better performances and more exploring in the moment. So if that makes sense, it's like, because I know certain artists that they just put out everything and, you know, God bless them. I just don't, like, I don't want to put something on that in a few years I don't want to play live. Like, ideally, I want the things that we do to be all-timers for us, you know?
Yeah. And I know whenever you talk to bands, particularly, it's usually pre-album. And how do you feel about the album coming out? Are you excited for fans to hear it? Now that it's been out for almost a year, do you think this album holds up? Is it one of your favorites? Are you happy with the reaction to it? Is this what you're going to be building off for the next album, if there's one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think of it like, I don't think it's really safe or healthy for me to like think about things as like, how did they do in the public eye? Like, it's just not constructive.
Fair.
But I do think I knew there was an immediacy to this record. Like, we could play, when we first started playing it live, I did notice that unlike album 3 and even 2, there was an immediate reaction to this where people could get with the music faster. It was that type of writing because I think we wrote it fast and it just had this like palpable, like, whoa, whoa. Like, talk about early Kings of Leon. When you put that on for somebody and let's say they had never heard any of those records, there is an immediacy to that. There's like kids exploring in a way. And that's what we felt like. So I think what I learned from it is like, just by setting it up the way we did, we were childlike, and that's a good thing. You know, that you're a little bit on your heels or something. You're not quite sure what you're doing. And that's where, you know, people wonder why people like live shows. It's not because everything goes perfect. In fact, when there's a mistake or something kind of like bad that happens, but the band has a moment with it, sometimes that's the thing you walk away remembering and really enjoying about the show. And I think that's often true in the music we hear, is like there's these strange mistakes that happen that become like the defining part of the song. So I think a lot of it is like what I took away from Brightside was like that there's a lot, I can have a lot more faith that it'll be okay and turn out all right. And I don't have to be going over it 100 times for it to be turning out all right. Because there's instances where something like on our first album, Big Parade, I don't like how that turned out on the album, but I like our live version, and that's okay. Like, people still got the heart of the matter. They got the crux of it. And I mean, when I listen to a lot of Leonard Cohen stuff, my dad listened to the album, The Future, a lot with us. And like the instrumentation on there is borderline bizarre. It's like weird, weird synths and just like tones I would never choose. And whenever I hear covers of his music, I'm always like, wow, like what a great song. And when I heard it, I knew it was good, but like, I still got the message, even if it's like muddied up. And I think that's what you can have a faith in fans about, is like, if they're really into the music, they'll figure it out. You don't have to get it like quote unquote perfect. You're just immortalizing it in that moment. But I mean, Bob Dylan's the same way, where a lot of people have issue with his voice. And it's like, when you hear another person sing it, you realize how good the melody was. He's been doing that the whole time. It's just, it's a little dirtied up in a cool way, or Kurt Cobain or something, where it's just like the ugliness of it makes it kind of more believable and beautiful.
Is it true that while you guys were recording this, for some reason there was a photo of And you mentioned this at the top of the episode, there was a photo of Noel and Liam from Oasis at Nebworth sitting in the studio. Is that true?
Yeah, our producer Simon Felice from the formerly from the Felice brothers, he's a good friend of mine. And you know, normally we've done three albums together as a band, and normally he'd put up a vision board and it would have all this stuff, quotes and various images and stuff to inspire us and kind of keep us on a path and like put our mind in a new place. And this time it was just one picture, and it was just of Liam and Noel at Nebworth, and it was their backs facing the crowd in black and white and like 250,000 people out there. And he's just like, I need you to understand that you two are the Lumineers. Like, you write the songs and you're sort of like the antenna for these songs, and you're, but you gotta like own this a little bit. This is like, you could say, oh shucks, ho hum, like you could do this humble act, but like there's some value in owning that that's who you are. Mm-hmm. And step into that a little bit, and if you build it, they will come, kind of thing. And so I think he always, like, he wasn't pushing us to become a bigger band just for bigger sake or something. I just think he felt like, you know, don't run from the thing that you're a big part of. Like, you know, just you're like, embrace this a little bit, and I think something cool can happen. And I think he was right. And it made us that sweat. I think there's a little bit of, I would say it's almost like innocence mixed with swagger, you know, like where you're like walking into your junior prom with like your collar pop or something. It's like, it's like, there's like something about it that feels like it's a driving kind of record. Like you'd go for a drive and have your hand out the window and smoke a cigarette and just drive a little faster than you should. It's like that. That's what our mindset was. And I think it made it onto the record in some ways.
Fuck, I love Oasis as well, but talking about people that you might not want to meet for fear that they might not like you, I think Noel and Liam are at the top of that list.
Yeah, I've seen him interviewed a lot, especially Noel. Liam just seems more like funny to me, but like Noel, depending on his mood, like I've seen him say beautiful things about, like, I don't know, a certain artist like Ed Sheeran. And then the next week he'll say horrible things. And it's like, I think deep down he's almost like, he has that hip hop sensibility about him where he's just like knows how to make controversy and keep it moving. But what, like, for all their antics, they're an insanely talented group. You know, like, I hope they get back together soon and there will be a lot of people buying tickets, including myself. But man, like, I think he's smarter than he lets on sometimes. It's almost like a guy talking shit at the bar, but he's reading these intense books at home or something.
It feels like he's just like, he'll just tell you what he thinks. So if you say something stupid or something he disagrees with, he'll let you know. He won't be polite about it. And I don't think it's personal. But fuck, you just open for you too. Like, if they get back together and, I don't know how opening acts work, if they put out applications, surely you guys are at the top of that list.
We would love to, man. I think it's like, we're not blood brothers or anything, you know, but we grew up a mile apart, me and Jer. And
yeah.
I think there's a kinship to be, you know, we've written music together for 17 years now. And there's something about that that is has always been rare, you know, but I'm sure, I would hope they would connect on that. It's just like, hey, the love of writing songs and like having a brotherly relationship with each other. It's not easy all the time as they have exemplified. But at the same time, like, the world is telling you it's worth it, you know, like, keep going. And you're like, yeah, you're right. This is special. And it's really, I think when things start rolling, it's easy to think that it will never stop. And it really requires like, I don't know, like a monk-like devotion to it, to stay good at it. Like when you think about the great songwriters out there that have maintained that quality, there's not that many, because you kind of sacrifice a lot around you to make that the most important thing. You know, going back to the Kings of Leon, I don't know how much time they would have put in when they were talking about those years, you know, becoming rock stars in their minds, but I would bet that they spent more time writing music in the beginning and have found that again. And that's what really makes them happy, because it is fun to like meet somebody and they're like freaked out that it's you. And you're like, it's just me. You know, and they were probably just walking around, you know, with their shoulders back and their heads high, like, fuck you, I'm in this band, fuck you. There's something to that that is really alluring. And then you realize, like, that's kind of temporary. And what's really cool is sitting in the studio and getting goosebumps because you just made something that is freaking you out. And that can be forever if you want it to be. And for us, you know, something like album three that we talked a few months before it came out in 19, it was like, that album meant so much to us. And that was not what I would consider like some commercial viable record. It was a record that was a concept record. And I love that we still play plenty of songs from that album live, and our fans can get with that just as much as they can get with the first record or the third, fourth. It doesn't matter. It's like, you know, there's a patience there. I hope there's a trust there that if we're putting something in front of you, it's because we thought it was our version of good. And and usually people say, again, that's what people sense. My least favorite music is when I think they're making it for me instead of making it for themselves. Like if they're not moved by it, but they thought I would like it, it's kind of like, ugh. Like, I want to know how weird and quirky you are. I don't want to like be impressed by how clever you are. You know what that's for? That's for like jingles on commercials. Go do that. Like that's not, you know, music, you know? So, yeah, it's a strange thing. But as I get older, I'm like, I think I was luckiest about all this that nothing ever happened until I was 30, because I probably was a lot more suggestible and interested in impressing maybe the wrong people when I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
And those are pitfalls. And I don't envy people who are like that child actor vibe where they get a lot soon. And then they're like, I look back with regret. And I'm like, dude, nobody fucking cared about me until I was like 30. So.
But that's the thing, right? Like you used to the child stars, they peak early and then they spiral. But I feel like that's sweet spot. It's the same with acting. Like I know that a lot of people say the reason people like say Steve Carell or Ricky Gervais, which I know is ironic because British office, US office, but the reason that they're apparently super sweet, humble guys is because they didn't get famous till they were in their 40s. They've grown up. They're not in the public eye. And by the time they do get in the public eye, they're adults. So,
and you kind of see through what people are doing when they kiss your butt. They don't really think that, most of them. They're like doing that because that's what, you know, they think they should be doing. Like most people don't think you're that great. It's just, I was a busboy for years and I was working at the service industry as a waiter, as like, you know, a server, a bartender, a barista. And I noticed how I was treated in each station. You know, so if I was like a manager, I remember I managed this deli and I was like getting shit on by like the employees, by the people who, the customers. If I was a bartender, I was like the man. And that doesn't make any sense. It's like, as a barista, you make way more complicated drinks, generally speaking, at an average coffee shop than you do at a bar where you're opening beer a lot and you're just like making a gin and tonic. It's like there's not much to it. There are mixologists, badass, but I'm saying it taught me a lot about like, that's just, they're doing that because that's the drug they want most from you, right? Like,
yeah.
Like you control their happiness in that moment so much as a bartender for certain people. And it was silly. It was like, man, the chefs in the back are doing the most and they don't get any of these tips. They just make any sense. And there was like not always like a through line of like who got what based on what. And I started to see that in, you know, when I was in college, I was the man because I was in college, but I was a musician, right? So you're like the top of the totem pole and socially. You're like, he's creative, but he's educated. You know, like there's this mystique to like, you're on the normal path, but you're on the outside of that a little bit. But when you get out of college, if that's the route you take. And then I stayed a musician. Now I'm a waiter. So all my friends now are like, the world looks at them like, you're killing it. And they look at me like, get a real job, you scumbag. And I remember going to my brother's. My brother was younger than me. He's younger than me. And he was there was like a family weekend. And my parents and I went down to visit him. And so I have like long hair and I'm meeting all these other families. And they're just so like put off by even just being a musician. And those are the same people who would one day probably later say, I know that guy. I'm proud of, like, but in the moment it actually irritated them. So you go from top of the food chain to like the lowest you can look, like you can be. And that's a really getting humbled. because you said the word humble before, like, is it humbling to play Coors? It's like, not to me, it's not humbling. It is humbling though to go to a parents' weekend and everybody your little brother is introducing you to is going like, so what do you do? And I'm like,
yeah,
well, I'm a barista and I work at this, like, I slice meats at a deli, but I'm a musician. Like, yeah, 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 me too. I'm a musician. Like,
yeah.
And it's sure. Like, to me, the Steve Carells and the Ricky Gervaises, and like, I feel like myself, it was really, really helpful to be shit on for a while because you realize that you're not as bad as they think. And when you get a lot of adulation, you're not as good as they think either. Like, there's like some true middle ground there. And you know when you did something well and you start to develop, I think, your own measures for when you're doing well, as opposed to always looking outside of that and saying, hey, was that good? Hey, was that good? Like, there has to be an awareness of it's the real world. And, you know, you are, if you're in a band and you're touring, you're sort of running a business, but at the same time, it's like, if you rely on that as your measure, it's so inaccurate half the time. You know, if we were to listen to people about, I remember Ophelia, they were like, are the people around us, I would say some people on our label were like, well, it doesn't have a guitar. Like, this isn't going to work. And we're like, well, what do you mean? And he's like, doesn't have a guitar. Your last album, that was like how you're known. And we're like, I know, isn't it great? It's a new thing. And they're like, no. And we're like, well, we like it. And then afterwards, they explain it away like, hey, this is, isn't this great? They're really like spreading out or spreading their wings or whatever they rationalize it as. But I think a lot of people, again, going back to the idea of like acting out of fear, I think they're scared of something because they know this other thing worked. And that's all they really can go off of. And it takes a special group of people around you to encourage you to, you know, explore that stuff and be free about it. But again, like, you kind of have to do that. My manager says this line, he says, keep giving them you until you is what they want. And it's like, I think that's a good way to do it, but it can be a lonely situation for a little while where you start to feel a little crazy.
It's wild as well to think about, again, that 2019 interview, 3 hadn't come out yet, and you were playing in front of thousands of people at Spend the Grass. Now you're coming back in, what, 2 weeks to Australia to play the Harvest Rock Festival alongside guys like Jack White and Crowded House, and you're doing your biggest Australian shows to date. That's crazy to think, right?
Yeah, and it truly, you know, with the pandemic, I think every band would tell you it turned everybody's expectations upside down. Like, well, maybe half the people will come. It's like so crazy. And I think I feel very grateful and lucky that people are still coming out to shows in general and coming to our shows, because it really reminded us of how fragile the whole thing can be. And even now we see it in the United States, especially because, you know, it's sort of easier to tour because you can go to all these places and it's just a drive. You know, it's not like in Europe, let's say as an example, you're going to country to country to country and it's like different rules. It makes it prohibitive. And here you're seeing people and they're going to concerts for the first time in 2+ years. And now what's against bands is, well, I can't go to all of them. I got to now pick the ones I want to go to. So now, you know, it's sort of like bottlenecked where everyone's on tour at the same time. And it's letting you know, I think, who people really care about, because they kind of like, they vote by the tickets they buy or something, you know? And that's a like heavy thing where you're like, it can be like, that could be humbling and that could be a sobering moment. But I feel like for us, it's somehow gotten better. But I also think part of it is that we just made music in a very old fashioned, simple way of like, it wasn't like the modern method. It was just what every band before us has done that we grew up listening to. It was just like, try to write good music, tour hard, hope for the best, you know, but do things you care about. And that's like, I mean, those are the bands I love. But again, it's like, that's not what everybody around you is going to tell you to do. They're going to say, you know, it'd be great, go do this thing. And you're like, ooh, that makes me cringe. And they're like, it's all right. Don't worry about that part. And that's what I would say, like, for younger artists coming up, I don't always envy, is like, I'm sure you've seen it where artists get on social media and they say, well, my label is requiring me to do this thing, so I'm doing it. And it's like, they're not requiring you to do that. Like, you might have like signed something maybe, but you agreed, say no next time. next time it comes around, tell them you won't do that stuff and do what you want to do. So there's like a weird double speak going on that I'm like, you're being a little disingenuous here. Like, you don't actually have to do that. You can just say no and like live with the consequences, but we all have our different ambitions, you know? And I think that that's sometimes what people are conflicted about.
All right. And before you go, can you tell us what the next 12 months look like? I know, again, you've got these Australian shows coming up. I know you've got a few in Japan and South Africa before the end of the year. And I think you've got some festivals mid next year, but are you going to be taking some time off? Are you going to be thinking about the next album? Are you already well ahead for the next album? Where are we at there?
I think we're chipping away at the next album. Jer's already sent me a lot of cool ideas and I've sent him a couple back. And so that's in like the infancy of that. And then I think next year, though it's not yet announced, there are a lot of dates forthcoming. So we'll be, I think it'll be some in North America and then some again, like in Europe and the UK, and just different spots that we weren't able to hit. We came out of the pandemic when I think one of every venue we played in Europe and the UK, they were like, you're the first band back. And we're like, I don't know if that's the best thing. I think we're going back to certain places because that run got cut in half based on just cancellation. So we'll do some of that and it'll be a pretty busy year. And then at the end of that, we'll start writing the next one. And I think next year we'll be touring and the following will be like writing and recording.
Right. Okay. So what, maybe a late 2024 release? Now I'm just putting pressure on you. I know.
I hope even sooner. Well, no, I mean, Brightside came fast, so I don't know. I would hope sooner, but we'll see.
Well, Wesley, it was so good to chat to you, man. Congratulations again on the album. Good luck with these Australian shows. Be kind to the country. I know I'm not there right now, but it's exciting timing. Yeah, I will. Let us know next time you're in town, because I think I would have missed you when you guys were actually playing here too.
So are you here? Are you in New York kind of like full time now?
Yeah, full time. Yeah.
I'm sure you got all the scoops, but I know some good spots. I know some good spots that have cropped up that over the years. I'll share some with you, but it's like an overwhelming, amazing city.
Awesome. Wesley, thank you so much, man. Again, good luck with the tour and we'll talk soon, dude.
All right, Neil. Take care, man.
This episode is proudly sponsored by Audio Technica Australia. Subscribe, rate, and review The Plug on your preferred podcast platform. And follow us on Instagram and YouTube at The Plug with Neil Griffiths and on TikTok at theplug.podcast to stay up to date with episode releases and giveaways.